We're talking about food politics and the evolution of school lunches in America here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this is that time of year when generous do-gooders pay off student lunch debt in their communities. You see it from NFL football players. You see it in a kindergartner who covered the lunch debt for about 120 of her fellow students through a hot cocoa stand in a San Diego district. NBC's Today Show anchors pondered that one.
How about that? 5 years old, guys.
Yeah, it's amazing when someone that young just knows to pay it forward.
So what questions do you have about our school lunch system, how it works? What do you want to know about its origins and the role of women, or lunch ladies, if you will, feeding children? We're at 800-642-1234 to join in. Jennifer Gaddis has spent the past decade researching the National School Lunch Program that was founded in 1946. She is an assistant professor in the Department of Civil Society and Community Studies at UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. Her new book is called The Labor of Lunch: Why We Need Real Food and Real Jobs in American Public Schools. Jennifer, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me, Kate.
So you use the term lunch ladies pretty freely in your research and in your writing, and you find that through dozens of interviews that this is not a derogatory term. When it comes to school lunches, why have women been at the forefront?
Well, I think that on the one hand, the term is something that I found a lot of the people that I interviewed really embraced, because they felt like, you know, a lot of them provide this kind of emotional nurturing to students, and they kind of identify as being second mothers. And so, like, these aspects relate more to what might be considered kind of this act of mothering, or things that they see really reflected in this title of lunch lady. There are some workers, though, who I interviewed who I would say don't feel quite the same way about the term. So I have a little section in the book where I kind of talk about my decision for why I chose to use it. And I think the main reason for me why it's important to use that term is actually to remind us of just how heavily gendered this job is. So even today, over 90% of people who work in school kitchens and cafeterias around the country are women. And the reason I think that's really important for us to remember is that the majority of the people who are doing this work in schools, which I think is a really valuable public service, are actually paid quite low wages. And so I think it's really important for us to remember that the people who are doing this very socially valuable work, really helping to make sure that the next generation of adults is nurtured, really aren't being well compensated for the work that they're doing. And it's disproportionately women. So I think it's really important for us to remember that that's the case, and to really revalue this work, because I think it's very important.
Not only women, but these are people working part-time. They're asked to say, hey, do you have 3 hours in the middle of your day to do this pretty labor-intensive work?
Yeah, and I think that originally it was really women who were doing this work, because basically the school lunch program started in the 1890s and kind of early 1900s, and there were a lot of women who really were volunteering, or who had this idea that we should really have nonprofit school lunch programs, and they were kind of the ones who spearheaded this new kind of initiative and really formed the core labor force. And I think that today what we're seeing happening is really since kind of the beginning of the 1970s, there's been this real trend toward what people in the industry called heat and serve food. So basically these items that are shipped in from whether it's factories or a central kitchen facility that's owned by like the city. They're kind of shipping in this pre-made food. And then, you know, if you don't need to cook from scratch using basic ingredients, you really only need workers for a short number of hours to unbox the food, put it on trays, reheat it, serve it to the kids, and clean up. So
when you described it as airline pack food, like, you know, you can hear, I wish I brought in one, because you can just hear yourself peeling off the cellophane on top.
Yeah, so those kinds of meals were introduced in the 1970s, and a lot of school districts, even though I think food in general in schools has gotten a lot better since the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act of 2010, there are a fair number of schools, particularly in urban areas, that still rely on that model of these little kind of prepacked meals. In fact, Madison Public Schools is one of them. And I think that one thing that people often don't realize is that it's actually much more difficult to improve the quality of the food from a taste perspective when you have that as your kind of model of food delivery. And also you're, you know, when you have that model of food preparation, what you're inadvertently doing is creating kind of these lower quality jobs and communities, because oftentimes it's not that the wages themselves are so low in comparison with other kinds of food service jobs. It's just that workers' access to hours is much shorter. So when I was interviewing people who work in school kitchens and cafeterias, it wasn't uncommon for them to tell me about two or three jobs that they were working at a time.
And especially in the summer when they're having to look elsewhere for jobs because they may not have a job at the school.
Yeah, and even right now, I think, so most schools right now are on winter break. And one of the things that I think a lot of people, if they haven't experienced hunger or poverty themselves, don't necessarily realize is that this can actually be a very challenging time, not only for kids who don't have access to free or reduced price meals, so breakfast and lunch through their schools, but also for hourly workers like the cafeteria workers who just don't have access to like their hours because they're not salaried during that time.
We're tracing the history of the National School Lunch Program with Jennifer Gaddis. She's author of the book, The Labor of Lunch. You can join in. Parents, what do you remember about the quality of food you ate in school back in the day versus what you see with your child's lunch today? Is it easier for you to trust the food you pack in a sack lunch that they might not get at school? Join in 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Jennifer, before we get way too far in the future, let's go back to the turn of the century, 1903. One of the people trying to crack the school lunch program at the time was a pioneer here at UW-Madison, Caroline Hunt, that you write about. She was the School of Human Ecology's first professor in 1903. What influence did she have on organizing and starting school lunch programs in America?
Well, interestingly enough, I think that she had a bigger influence because she left UW-Madison. And it's a little bit unclear if you read about her history, whether she left voluntarily or if she was actually fired by the Board of Regents. And I think one thing that a lot of people don't realize about home economics, especially people who maybe have experienced home economics as more of this kind of stitch and stir, learn how to sew, do a little bit of cooking in class, is that home economics actually had some pretty radical roots behind it. So there were certain home economists who were really interested in trying to get women to understand what they could do with their wealth. So given that they were the ones who were making purchasing decisions surrounding like what food they were buying, any kind of household goods they were buying, women like Caroline Hunt were saying, well, you should think about the ethics behind like how that food or how those like candlesticks or you know whatever household goods people were buying at the time are produced, and you should make sure that the workers are being treated fairly and that the companies aren't like exploiting the environment and that kind of thing. So she was really interested in getting people to have the skills that they needed to really understand how to make those kinds of ethical purchasing decisions. And food purity was a big thing as well. So teaching women to be able to use these new kinds of skills related to like how to actually test for adulteration in foods and things of that nature were things that she was really trying to pass on. So she was going kind of much beyond this idea of just, you know, household domestic chores to really empowering women to understand more about how the world kind of functioned around them and to play a greater role in the economics and kind of technological systems of the time. So she did leave the university and started to work for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and specifically the Bureau of Home Economics. And it's from there that she started to issue these kinds of pamphlets that would sort of go out. People may be familiar with like the extension model of, you know, this idea of having information that's generated from kind of a smaller group of people, and then it kind of was disseminated more broadly. So she was basically kind of operating like an extension agent, where she was authoring these pamphlets that would explain kind of how to set up school lunch programs, what sort of menus tended to work well. And so people would read these pamphlets and kind of be able to replicate some of these best practices from other places that had created programs first.
We're looking at the social, political, the economic systems of grown-up around school lunch in America, getting the historical context with Jennifer Gaddis. Her new book is called The Labor of Lunch, and she writes about how we can improve public school lunches in our country. Your thoughts, too. What value do school lunch workers provide to students in the lunchroom? Are you taking action at your school to improve the quality of food and the pay for workers? What are your roadblocks on this issue? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a moment with Jennifer Gaddis right here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about school lunches in America and the history that informs what kids have on their lunch trays today. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. And a real central question here, why have multiple generations of school, kitchen, and cafeteria workers faced really an uphill battle when trying to care for the children they feed. Why do you think there is resistance to change around school lunches? Has your district found new ways to incorporate local ingredients or to get kids excited about new meal options, new menu items? Are you a parent concerned about sodium or preservatives? What questions do you have about nutrition? Join in 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. Jennifer Gaddis traveled the country visiting more than 24 school districts, interviewing over 60 school food service employees, and her new book is called The Labor of Lunch. Jennifer, let's go back to the Great Depression here. As you do the research on how school lunches are evolving in this country, our country is in the throes of the Great Depression. What is happening with the rise of school lunch at this time?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, in part because I know that there are some people who are kind of returning to this history and thinking about how school lunch could be incorporated into something like a Green New Deal, actually, at the moment. So in any case, what really was happening during the Great Depression time was we had not only a lot of people who were out of work, but we also had these real issues with supply and demand in the farm sector. So school lunch kind of became this way to solve two problems at once. So these nonprofit school lunch programs both needed labor in order to get them up and running and to make sure that communities had these nonprofit school lunch programs to provide free or very low-cost meals to students or really to any young people who needed access to food. But we also had what was kind of considered to be an oversupply of certain foods that was making it difficult for farmers to make a living. So the U.S. Department of Agriculture said, well, we can take these, like, quote-unquote surplus foods and send them to schools because that's a politically and kind of morally acceptable.
It's like
outlet.
Suddenly that's a socially okay thing to do.
Exactly.
Like, we can regulate markets here by just getting kids in here.
So it really helped that there were poor children who needed food, like who were very hungry, because they were seen as kind of this morally deserving outlet for surplus food. So really during the Great Depression, the model that we see today of having some sort of federal support for national school lunch program was originated. And one of the things I kind of like to tell people is that often when we talk about school lunch in America, people will say that the program was founded in 1946. And that's true. That's when we passed the National School Lunch Act. But I really like to remind people that there was about 50 years of activism and kind of experimentation at the local and state level before that. And I think it's really important to remember that because it really helps us to, I think, remind ourselves about, like, what's possible and what's important at the local level to be able to really create these new templates that can then be sort of replicated at the national level.
I was just blown away. During the Works Progress Administration, 64,000 school lunch workers by 1941. That's a lot of people in those kitchens.
Yeah, and they were disproportionately really trying to hire women who they thought wouldn't have jobs otherwise, and also young people. So there was a youth corps as well that was involved in that. And I think that that was a really important source of employment for a lot of these women and communities who maybe were primary providers for their families. And I think that, you know, even the kind of early school lunch programs in the progressive era, so the 1890s to the 1920s, one of the things that those founders talked about as well was the importance of really making sure that these jobs were high quality jobs for women, because they recognized at the time that a lot of women were being funneled into, like, factory jobs and things like that that might not have been, like, the most, like, safe working conditions. So they really wanted to do better for other women, especially working class women.
So in government then, what was it that led to the creation of the National School Lunch Program and got this legislation passed?
I think there were a few factors. So one was actually that it was very popular. So throughout the Great Depression and World War II, there were a lot of school lunch programs around the country. And many of them actually during World War II had pretty significant school and community gardens attached to them. So I think people saw that these school lunch programs were an effective way of providing healthy food to kids. And also more women, I think, entered the workforce during World War II. And it was kind of considered, like, helpful, you know, that they didn't have to be at home waiting to feed their kids. Instead, they could rely on the public sector to essentially have a solution for making sure their kids were nourished during the school day. So I think that there was a lot of support from teachers, a lot of support from medical professionals, a lot of support from parents to create a permanent program. And so that kind of coincided with this recognition that a lot of soldiers who were deemed like unfit for military service were actually unfit because they had had some sort of disease that was linked to malnutrition. So I think that there was this real realization that as a country, if we want to invest in our like military might, we also have to make sure that we're investing like in the people who could potentially be called into service if we were to have another war as well. So this idea of what was then called defense nutrition really took off. And then I think the third piece of it was just this concern that something similar to the Great Depression could happen again in farming communities. So there was this concern that after the war ended, that there could be this real drop in farm prices. And so they wanted to ensure that there was some sort of kind of safety valve almost to be able to remove these quote unquote surplus commodities. And so schools became this really important mechanism once again for ensuring that they could regulate these markets in a way that would make sure that there wasn't another kind of crash.
Talking with Jennifer Gaddis, assistant professor at UW-Madison School of Human Ecology, and she's taken a really close look at the food children eat at school and the people who serve it and the systems around the school lunch program. Do you work in food service at a school district? What are work conditions like? What is the pay like? Is your district doing something new and novel in this area? Join in 800-642-1234. Jennifer, let's look at the private sector getting involved in food service. And we see the large corporations like Aramark, for instance, today. What impact did that have on school lunches?
Well, I think that it's important to realize that companies like Aramark, Chartwell, Sodexo, and there's a fair number of smaller private management companies as well. I know Tahir is one, for instance, that is pretty prominent in this region. And they're not all created equal. I think that there is some difference at the local level in terms of how they operate. But in general, these are for-profit companies that are operating in a not-for-profit program. So you kind of always have to ask yourself when a for-profit entity is in a nonprofit setting, how are they generating profit in a way that the school district, you know, wasn't itself? And usually the answer is through economies of scale in terms of their purchasing. So they might be, if they have contracts in lots of different schools, purchasing the same items for all of those schools. So that can kind of work against these trends toward more locally sourced food. It can also work against this trend toward being more responsive to who a group of students actually is in a school. So this idea of serving culturally appropriate food can be more challenging if you're not cooking from scratch. Because you can do lots of things with basic ingredients, but if you're relying on like, you know, pre-finished foods and everything kind of looks the same regardless of whether you have you know, students from very, very different cultural ethnic backgrounds, I think that that's not the greatest situation. But usually, whether it's food costs, if it's not that, it's going to be labor costs that they're really trying to drive down in order to kind of carve out a profit for themselves.
Right, because if they have a vacancy in that school cafeteria or in the kitchen, it would perhaps boost their bottom line if they don't fill it right away, or if they can do, you know, just as much work with less labor.
Right. So if they can find ways to sort of squeeze the workers to where they'll stay and try to kind of protect the kids, that can be one way that they can eke out some additional profit. But I would say that the most common way is actually by changing the type of foods that are served. So it's kind of more efficient to be having workers just serve like prepackaged, individually like wrapped in plastic things. You almost don't even really need a person if the company has made sure that it meets all the scientific nutrition requirements set by the government and it's already portioned in plastic. Like a lot of these kinds of grab and go foods where kids just kind of come up to the line and take their own components or things that are like reheated in their own little plastic bags by the workers. Like those are ways that a lot of these companies can be purchasing a lot of food in bulk and simultaneously reducing the need for on-site labor. But I don't think that that's really the best situation for the health of kids, the livelihoods of these workers, or the ability for us to use school lunch programs to support local farmers.
Where did we see the fall of the nutrition and the food, you know, just the holistic, you know, food and the quality of food? Where did it fall off in this timeline?
Well, I think it's always been a struggle. I think it's been something that the founders of the nonprofit school lunch movement, as I like to think of it, really have always struggled to attain. So they have always sort of seen the educational potential of really thinking about food as not just something that like fuels kids through the day, but as something that would teach them about math, teach them about science, teach them about nature, teach them about nutrition, teach them about culture. But I think that for a lot of these people who are involved in school lunch programs, they never really saw the funding for that educational side of things. In the U.S., like, we do so little nutrition education in comparison with some of the other countries where I've been doing research on their school lunch programs. And I think that, you know, as far as the food preparation goes, that really started to shift in the 1970s with this entrance of a lot of big food manufacturers into schools. So actually, I think the kind of content of school lunches has improved since 2012. We see a lot more like fresh fruits and vegetables and whole grains. So it's like the ingredients are better, but the preparation isn't changing in a lot of places. And I think it's because of this underfunding.
We're going in depth with author Jennifer Gaddis on school lunches in our country. You can join in 800-642-1234. Back in a moment, right here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for an hour-long conversation on school lunches in America here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A proposed rule change by the Trump administration would cause nearly a million children to lose automatic access to free school lunch. And in announcing the rule change over the summer, Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue said that it would save roughly $2.5 billion a year in SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Does your family depend on a nutritious school lunch being there for your child every day? What worries you most about access to a healthy meal for them? What barriers do you have for getting proper nutrition for your student? Join in with your situation, 800-642-1234. The new book is called The Labor of Lunch, Why We Need Real Food and Real Jobs in American Public Schools. And Jennifer Gaddis is an assistant professor of civil society and community studies at UW-Madison, and she stays with us. Jennifer, you write that more aggressive government regulation of around ingredients is unlikely under the Trump administration. And the president has made comments on the campaign trail about getting rid of the, quote, FDA food police, the Food and Drug Administration, and said that agriculture would, quote, not be regulated based upon the latest trend on social media. What do you see around government regulation today and school lunches?
Well, I think that the most significant changes to school lunches in at least a generation happened under the Obama administration in 2012 with the enactment of the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act. And that was something that really improved the nutritional profile, but didn't look at something that a lot of people in the industry refer to as ingredients of concern. So those are things like high fructose corn syrup, artificial colors, additives, things like that, that are typically added to foods during industrial processing. So a lot of leading school districts and what I refer to as the real food movement are kind of working themselves to remove these ingredients from their supply chains. So they might be talking to manufacturers if they're kind of large enough school districts like New York City public schools
or have Austin a lot of public powers. Schools, yes. I think you found as well in Texas.
Yeah. So some of these larger school districts, some of them are working kind of independently with more regional processors, and some of them are working in coalitions to really combine their voices and say, we really want like cleaner industrial food. So I think that the government really isn't taking any action now, and also didn't really take any action in 2012 on some of these things that parents and food service directors and dietitians might think are really not the best kind of chemicals to be exposing children to. But there are some really forward-thinking districts that are kind of doing that work themselves. So one route is really in working with these manufacturers, and the other route is really returning to cooking from scratch and then screening much more carefully, okay, you know, what are the different kinds of ingredients that we're bringing into our kitchens that we're going to cook with. So a lot of the dietitians that I interviewed would tell me about how really this return to scratch cooking was something that enabled them to improve the quality of the food quite a bit by not only removing these ingredients of concern, but also by creating up these kind of new opportunities to source more local produce through what are called farm-to-school programs.
Well, let's take a call now. Jim joining us from Cedarburg. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. Thank you. I would like to know if, in your research, did you come upon differences in the length of time for lunch, the lunch period itself? I'm a retired boomer. We had a full hour from 12 to 1. We went home for lunch. My mom would even invite the teacher once in a while to
goodness.
At our house. Yeah.
Jim, thank you for the call. What about the amount of time that kids have to eat these lunches?
Yeah, thank you so much for the question. So I think that that's a really big problem right now is the shortening period of time that kids have. I think that another thing that Jim's call sort of brought up was this idea that there used to be some school lunch programs where only some kids would stay and others would be able to go home for lunch. So back when we had a lot more of what people called neighborhood schools, it used to not be so uncommon, especially in urban areas, for kids to walk home for lunch. So I think that what ended up happening is as more and more kids really came to depend on the National School Lunch Program for access to free and reduced price meals, a lot of schools had a hard time with the capacity of just making sure that they were feeding the kids in this time period. So if they weren't originally building schools with this idea of we're going to feed, 600 kids at lunch, they might have been repurposing, for instance, like a basement or, using a gym space with these big tables that they would sort of roll out during lunchtime and roll, away during other periods of time. So a lot of schools, because they weren't originally built with this idea of serving school lunches, had to sort of figure out, okay, well, how can we accommodate people? So I think that that's one of the big reasons why we started to see these short lunch periods. It was this real issue of capacity in physical spaces. And now I think it's not only that, but also this additional pressure of school lunch really not being viewed as so much of an important part of the educational day and so much pressure to be devoting time to other sorts of like instructional purposes in schools.
It reminds me of what you found in New Iberia, Louisiana, where the community knew who worked in the lunch kitchen because of the bruises or the boiling and the burns because these are environments where you found no air conditioning and they're in heavy industrial kitchens.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that for a lot of school kitchens, they were sort of put in places almost like as an afterthought of like, we have to make this work. And, there wasn't always the investment in equipment or in physical space that really needed to be there in order to not only make the environment really safe for workers, but also to make sure that kids would have a really relaxed time to eat. And it's interesting comparing the U.S. with, I actually have started doing some research in other countries, and Japan is one of those countries and is often talked about as kind of being this world leader in nutrition education. And they actually don't serve their meals in a cafeteria setting. They actually pretty much cook everything from scratch, but then they have the kids go pick up these carts that they bring into their classrooms. And then the kids kind of take their desks and they build these little pods of like 4 to 6 people. So it's kind of like a communal space. And they bring kind of their own cutlery and like little like placemats from home. So it kind of creates more of this personalized atmosphere. And then they take turns serving each other. And they actually have about 45 minutes to an hour. So I think that in the case of the United States, it's going to be a challenge to really expand lunch periods a whole lot unless we think about the infrastructure question, just because a lot of schools are kind of already doing the best they can with the number of kids they need to feed.
We're looking at how the quality of food children receive at school has been changing, declining, how we might change it back with Jennifer Gaddis. Her book is called The Labor of Lunch, and you can join in 800-642-1234. Parents, what do you remember about the quality of food you ate in school back in the day versus what your child is getting today? Join in. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Christy now in Appleton. Hi, Christy.
Hi, good morning. I went to a small Catholic grade school in Madison, and we only had one staff member in our kitchen. So the model that they used was that the students actually helped out. Fourth and fifth graders wiped off all the tables. Sixth and seventh graders did the dishes, and eighth graders served the food. And I was just wondering if that's a common model or if that was pretty unique.
Wow. Thanks, Christy, for that question. So one thing that I would wonder is whether your school, because it was a Catholic school, actually participated in the National School Lunch Program. So the National School Lunch Program currently, about 95% of schools across the country do opt into this program. And the other 5%, some of them actually offer their own lunch programs. And a lot of those schools are private schools, some of which are religious. And so they don't operate under the same kinds of rules and restrictions as the National School Lunch Program. So my guess would be that what you experienced was kind of able to happen because the school was not part of the National School Lunch Program.
Well, Christy, thank you so much for the call. Paul from Eau Claire wrote in to say, I can duplicate school lunches at home for about a third of the cost. Are my lunch fees subsidizing other lunches?
Yeah, so I think that one of the things that we see is that on the one hand, kids currently qualify for free, reduced price, or full price lunches based on their family income. So if you're 130% or lower of the federal poverty line, your kids would get free lunch. If you're between 130 and 185%, you'd pay 40 cents per lunch. And if you're 185% or above the federal poverty line, you just pay whatever the district sets as the price. So local schools set their own prices for paid lunches. And most of them are around $2 to $3 each, but I actually have some students here at UW-Madison who are from the East Coast who have told me that at some of their schools, their high school lunches were like $5.85. And they said that they didn't participate, not because the food didn't look good, but because, you know, their families couldn't afford like that price for three kids every day. So I think that there are certainly families that really struggle to afford the full price of school lunches, but even the full price that a lot of schools are charging. So typically, this $2 to $3 is actually a little less than what it costs them to produce school lunches. So there's some legislation right now pending that would actually increase the reimbursement rate from the federal government by about 30 to 40 cents per lunch to really make it to where the cost of producing lunches is the same as the cost that the federal government is giving schools. So right now, what ends up happening is when parents are paying for their own children's school lunches, it's really hard to generalize about whether or not they're subsidizing lunches for other people, because it really depends if that price that the local school district has set is like lower than the cost of production or higher than the cost of production.
There are so many different formulas going on all across the country, and it varies by school district.
And I think that that's also one of the things that is really fueling this crisis of lunch shaming and lunch debt in schools, is a lot of people who are kind of right above that threshold for qualifying for reduced price lunches, I think really struggle with affording lunch fees, and it might kind of fluctuate from week to week, which can make the accounting really hard to keep track of.
Author Jennifer Gaddis is our guide as we look at how to reimagine school kitchens and cafeterias in America. Her new book is called The Labor of Lunch. Are you a family who has opted out of school lunch? How would lunches need to change at your school for your child to participate in school lunches? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Jennifer Gaddis here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about school lunches in America here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So my kids and I, we sit down with the school lunch calendar the Sunday night ahead of a new month. They read the lunch options, they deliberate, they each circle the school lunches they want to eat, and they X out the days they want to brown bag it from home. They count up the days they'll eat school lunch, and then they do the multiplication, right, to figure out what we owe. So they're part of the middle class, and therefore they have the luxury of choice in eating school lunch or opting to pack from home. How do you figure out school lunch in your family? Do you have a system? Are you concerned about school lunch debt and lunch shaming? Still time for you, 800-642-1234. Jennifer Gaddis' new book is called The Labor of Lunch, and she stays with us for the hour. Let's go to Mary now in Menasha. Hi, Mary.
Good morning. I just wanted to make a comment. My daughter goes to Menasha High School, and they have a company that came in, I believe it's Fort Farms, and they're growing all of the lettuce for the kids' school lunch program hydroponically. And my daughter, who wasn't really a lettuce eater, has really kind of embraced the idea of eating this healthy way, and they're seeing a real uptick, I guess, at school of kids embracing this healthy option that they're giving them. And I just wanted to talk about the innovation of that, because I think it's just really kind of incredible what the school district has embraced for the kids, and they're also using these systems as a teaching tool for the kids in the classrooms.
Wow, Mary, that sounds very creative. Have you seen that, Jennifer?
Yeah, thank you, Mary, so much for sharing that example. I think that there are a wide variety of different ways in which schools are trying to experiment with this type of thing, and I think it's exactly the direction that we need to be headed in. And one of the things that I really like about this example is that it's not only treating like the growing of lettuce as an educational opportunity for teaching the kids, but it's also really providing like this healthy, locally grown food for direct use in the cafeterias. So I think that all that is really important, and the kind of research that people have done on school gardens and other kinds of programs like this really show that kids like vegetables more and are more willing to consume them when they've had a hand in growing them. So I think it's not true to say that kids just don't like vegetables. I think that there are a lot of things that we can do to help them like consuming vegetables more. So inviting them to help grow them is one aspect of that that I think is really a very, very promising one.
And it sounds like there's a partnership here mm-hmm. between Fork Farms and the school or school district. What have you seen in terms of partnerships? I know you looked specifically at Minneapolis Public Schools and some partnerships with farms.
Yeah, I think that one thing that a lot of schools that have farm-to-school programs will do is they'll partner with local farms who will not only sell product to the schools, but also will have farm owners or farm workers come in and actually talk to the kids about like the farm operation and kind of give them this window into where their food has come from. So I think that that's probably the most common thing that I've seen in terms of like a for-profit company partnering with schools is this kind of educational, like in the classroom, just kind of show and tell type thing. But I think that there are also a lot of nonprofits that have partnered with schools to really support food education. So the largest one nationally is Food Corps, and they're actually linked to AmeriCorps. So they have a couple hundred like service members, predominantly in lower income schools around the country. But there's all sorts of kind of smaller local nonprofits. Like for instance, REAP here in Madison is one that does a lot of farm to school partnership work with the Madison Public Schools here. So I think that there's lots of these different partnerships, but the majority of them do tend to be between nonprofits who are interested in healthy eating and local food and the schools.
Mary, thanks so much. Let's go to Cynthia now in Menominee. Hi, Cynthia. Oh, and Cynthia, are you there?
Yes,
hi.
I'm here.
Oh, good.
I was just cleaning while I was listening to you on the speaker.
Good for you.
I too am a baby boomer. I remember lunches in the schools when I, and we had a cook on site. They were great lunches. We learned to eat foods we'd never tried before. And when another baby boomer called in and said kids used to go home, well, a lot of kids now don't have anybody at home to make lunches, and they don't have anybody at home to make breakfast. I don't remember what else I had mentioned.
Well, Cynthia, I think you really are grasping at an important point here about relationships and some of the bonding that happens with school lunch workers and who are caring for the kids that they're serving meals to. What are those relationships like, Jennifer?
Yeah, I think that that's a really important point. And also like this idea that the food was actually really tasty. So Cynthia mentioned that these were good lunches. And I think that when workers have the ability to prepare meals from scratch for the kids that they're feeding, they take a lot of pride in it and they get to know kids over an extended period of time. So if you're talking about an elementary school that goes, for instance, from kindergarten through grade six, cafeteria workers might be the only person in the building who actually sees them grow from kindergarten through age six and might also know their siblings. And if they've been in the district long enough, they could know like the kids, like aunts, uncles, parents, you know, it could be this multi-generation affair. And that's something that I really found when I talked to a lot of the cafeteria workers who were older, like who had worked in school food service for 30 years or so, they would remember, scratch cooking, and they would remember you know, the quality of their job used to be better. And they would say, you know, yeah, my position used to be like 7 or 8 hours. Now it's 5 3/4, but I still, you know, barely get benefits, or maybe I don't, depends on the district. So I think that a lot of the workers themselves really understand this link between preparing food from scratch as something that enables them to really provide healthier, tastier food for the kids that they're caring for, and is something that really enables them to stay in the job for a lot longer, which I think really matters quite a bit for the quality of care that kids experience. Because one thing I think a lot of people don't realize is that most of the entry-level positions in school food service departments now actually struggle quite a bit with turnover. And a lot of it is because, you know, people can't afford to have a 3-hour, 4-hour job in the middle of the day. So actually the workers who right now tend to have the most like one-on-one contact with students. So people who are serving as cashiers or who are dishing out food in the service line are these entry-level employees who are cycling through a lot faster. So when that happens, they're not really able to stay in one place and really form these deep connections with the kids. And a lot of the research kind of from the public health world that looks at how you get kids to actually eat healthier foods suggests that it's actually really important for kids to have a positive relationship with the people who are feeding them. So I think if we want to use schools as a place to introduce kids to potentially unfamiliar foods and really help kind of shape tastes in a healthier direction, it's actually really important that we invest in the quality of relationships between the workers and the kids themselves.
One point I really want to get at is something you've been saying, to opt in for parents to make use of the school lunch program and have their kids use it and really rally around it. Why are you trying to deter people who can pack a home lunch, you know, to stop doing that?
Well, it's all about what schools can actually do with additional investment. So I think that that strategy really only works if you also have a school food service director who really wants to move in a progressive direction, or who have kind of a group of community advocates that are willing to kind of co-shape this vision for an alternative of what school lunch could be. So Austin Public Schools tends to be my favorite example to talk about in this, because their food service director went on the local news at the beginning of the school year, and they're already doing a lot of really great things. So they do a lot of scratch cooking, they source a lot of food locally, and a lot of the ingredients that they source are what we call clean label. So they're doing a lot of great stuff. And they even signed on to something called the Good Food Purchasing Program. So a lot of great stuff already, but they only have about 50% participation. So their food service director went on the local news and said, hey, all of you parents who are packing school lunches for your kids, if you would let your kids eat school lunch one time per week, I could afford to serve grass-fed beef in all of the cafeterias. If you were to let them eat 2 times per week, I could afford to serve organic produce. 3 times per week, I could afford to serve organic milk. So on the one hand, I think this is actually something that would really benefit a lot of middle-class families who maybe can't afford to like source those foods themselves, or just don't have the time to prepare like hot lunches every day. But it would also really benefit a lot of lower-income families. And I think we need to take that aspect of food justice really seriously in terms of thinking about which kids get access to which quality of food and why.
Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jennifer Gaddis is an assistant professor in the Department of Civil Society and Community Studies at UW-Madison. Her new book is called The Labor of Lunch, Why We Need Real Food and Real Jobs in American Public Schools. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.